Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's really a pleasure to see this gathering in here coming together on November 29th, the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. It has been a day that was slow in coming. Since the signing of the Oslo Agreement, there's been almost silence in the streets and silence in many corners of the American political activism area in relations to Palestine. Part of it is due to people celebrating what came to be known as the peace process, thinking that the peace process really have accomplished an opening toward settling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But in reality, the Oslo peace process has to be understood as being an American attempt to try to settle the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to the benefit of Israel and the United States, and in essence to extend American hegemony over the region. If we recognize the September 13, 1993 Oslo Agreement between the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and Israel, it should be studied not for the things that it included, but rather all the things that were left out of the peace process and the Oslo Agreement. What the Oslo Agreement left out was 3.5 to 4.5 million Palestinian refugees, which constitute the core of the Palestinian cause. These refugees that live in Lebanon, in Jordan, in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in Egypt, and you will find many of them in here in the United States. Actually, last year when we were doing some work around Palestine, I met an individual who was 7 times refugee. His family was in the 1948 area. He was expelled with his family in 1948 war. He settled in the West Bank. In 1967, he was expelled again, and therefore he made it to Jordan. In 1970, what came to be known for the Palestinians as Black September, he was expelled from Jordan into Lebanon. After the civil war in Lebanon, he migrated and went to Kuwait. During the war in Kuwait, he was expelled into the no man's zone, and then finally he made it to the United States and he lives in Santa Clara right now. His story is not a unique story. Rather, you find many Palestinians, if not been 3 or 4 or 5 times refugees, forced to move based on their nationality being Palestinian. To be born as a Palestinian, you're a political crisis waiting to happen. Because wherever you are, you have to confront the issue of who you are. You're a Palestinian, a nation that doesn't exist, even though it is at the center of the political conflict in the Middle East. So the Oslo Agreement failed at the fundamental issue of really addressing the Palestinian refugees. The second issue that Oslo have failed to address, which we continue to point out time and time again, is the settlements and settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And I always mention that we are in the 21st century and we're still speaking of settlement and settlers and the right of settlers to be in the occupied territories. The question that we really need to ask is why are these settlers are still in the occupied territories? Why are they still in the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated areas in the world? Still, we have 30% of the land in Gaza is reserved for these settlers. Now, if you notice during the Oslo Agreement, after the Oslo Agreement was signed in September 13, 1993, there were many polls conducted among the Palestinian population. And the ratio of support to the peace process was running as high as 80% in some sectors. Because really people felt and believe that this Oslo Agreement is going to lead to the settling of the situation, ending the confiscation of land, the ending of the occupation, and that finally they will get rid of the yoke of the Israeli occupation from their shoulder. But what they realized is that the Oslo Agreement was not an agreement that saw an end. Rather, it was only an agreement of principles. And what Israel, through the process of 8 years, was building facts on the ground. That every time there was negotiations taking place, the Israeli negotiators were negotiating on the table while in reality were building settlements, confiscating lands, building bypass roads and expanding settlements. If people can remember and recall, when Shamir was in power and the Israelis were asking for the $10 billion loan guarantees, every time that James Baker was visiting Israel, they welcomed him. They did not welcome him with a ceremony or a reception or some food that he could eat. They welcomed him with a new settlement. This was what the Israeli right wing and the Likud said, that every time that Baker is going to come to Israel, we're going to welcome him with a new settlement being placed. Also, I need to remind you, when Likud was defeated by Barak in the last election, once the election was decided, Sharon said it's a land grab day. Meaning once Likud was defeated, he made a wide call for the settlers to grab as much land as possible. And overnight, we had settlements springing all over the hilltops over Palestine and the occupied territories. Now, to think about it, how this takes place. These settlers only bring a mobile units. Some of the things that we use maybe in classrooms in many of the underfunded schools in the inner cities. We don't have space for classrooms, so we bring these mobile units. What these settlers bring is they bring these units and they put it on the land. Whether it's owned by Palestinian or anyone else, it becomes a fact on the ground. In any civilized country, and in here civilized, I'm using it between two parentheses because some of the civilized countries have committed far more atrocities. Need to remind you of the Native Americans in this country, the slavery era, and the French who are, you know, they call themselves the most civilized, but really we did not experience any of their civilization in North Africa. But nevertheless, civilized norms call for you that if somebody comes and grab a piece of land, that the first issue is for somebody to determine who owns this land. But in Israel and in the occupied territories, when a settler places this mobile unit in a land, the army comes and protects them. The army provides a border around them, and nobody is allowed to come and claim this land, and they refer the matter to the court. And the court is usually made of 3 Israeli officers, because fundamentally, Israel has deemed the land of the West Bank to be disputed territories. That is a legal terminology. If it's a disputed territory, meaning that the settler who placed his home there, the mobile home in there, has the same claim to the land as the person who's been living there generation after generation. This was a legal trick, began in 1973, which continued to be at the foundation of the dispute over the occupied land in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, under the Fourth Geneva Convention passed in 1949, it is prohibited for an occupying power to move part of its civilian population to the land it occupies. That's the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 33, is prohibited for any occupying power. Ironically enough, that the Fourth Geneva Convention came into existence. The negotiations for its passing was a result of the atrocities that took place in Europe during the Second World War. We as a collective, the world community, said that never again we would allow a state to act in such a way to move civilian population from one area to the other, to completely depopulate territories. And the world community came and signed this Fourth Geneva Convention. Israel right now is the number one country in the world that violates the Fourth Geneva Convention. Systematically, and the United States continue to provide the security and provide the international blanket. So wherever Israel is being brought to criticism, we see the United States stands to prevent this criticism from materializing into actual policy that would could put pressure on Israel. We see this in the United Nations. We see it in many of the other avenues vis-a-vis Israel treatment and occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, in here, the issue of Jerusalem is very important in terms of settlement and settlers. Over the past 30 years, from 1967 until this year, the territory and the space or the landmass of Jerusalem has been expanded 3 times. So when we speak of Jerusalem in 1967, it's not the same as is today. The territory has been expanded by taking, confiscating land and building settlements, and once those settlements are built, incorporating those settlements into what is called the municipality of Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, 160,000 settlers right now are constituted as being part of the citizens of Jerusalem. And this continues to increase with the recent building of the Har Homa settlement, which is known to people in the Palestinian area as Jabal Abu Ghneim, which is here also as part of the colonizing project, is really stamping out the indigenous names of cities and stamping on them names that the Israelis, so 10, 20 years down the line, you no longer can identify the land and the city and the village that was there. Har Homa has been designated by Likud government, and I need all here to remind people, because in the United States there is a love with the labor government, because people celebrate when labor comes to power and think that labor is more amenable to peace process. When Netanyahu proposed to build the settlement outside Jerusalem, Har Homa, Jabal Abu Ghneim, the world community was up protesting this and was forced to stop the expansion and forced to stop this settlement. Once Barak came, the whole world looked the other way, and actually Barak government was the one that went ahead with the building of the settlement, and 3 weeks ago, he also proposed increasing the settlement size by building 4,500 units in the city, in the area where is the settlement of in Jabal Abu Ghneim. Now, when we speak of these settlements, we need to really realize that these settlements are for Jews only. These settlements are for Jews only, meaning a Palestinian who is an Israeli citizen, who holds the Israeli passport and participates in the whole totality of the Israeli enterprise is prohibited by law from purchasing an apartment or any property within these settlements. Assuming that a Palestinian wants to buy this apartment, assuming, this is an assumption on my part. This is an assumption. Assuming that a Palestinian got up in the morning, he had a fever, and thought that maybe it would be better for me to buy a property, to buy an apartment in the new settlement in Jabal Abu Ghneim. It has a nice atmosphere surrounded by trees, and it's in a close proximity that I could go and pray in Masjid al-Aqsa on Friday. By law, he cannot do this. By law. Not only this, but also in Israel itself. In Israel itself, 92% of public land is set to the benefit of Jews only inside Israel. This was the public land been transferred to the National Jewish Fund. Meaning that apartments built in Israel itself, and here mind you, because I'm not speaking about the problematic Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Those have genetic makeup that makes them resist. I'm talking about the docile Arabs who are in Israel itself, been quote unquote domesticated in Israel from 1948 until now. If an Arab wanted to buy an apartment in an area in Israel, he is prohibited to do so. And we have a number of cases where actually Arab soldiers who serve in the Israeli army, who are Druze soldiers, Druze Arabs, who wanted to buy apartments are prohibited from doing so by law. Therefore, what we're talking about settlements and settlers inside the West Bank, these settlers and settlements are reserved for one group only. And Palestinians in Israel itself, they pay taxes to the state. And these taxes that are paid to the state also benefit one group to the exclusion of the other. So the Oslo Agreement have not dealt with the issue of settlements and settlers. All settlements under international law are illegal. all settlements under international law are illegal. The four Geneva Convention, they're illegal also under United Nations resolutions. They're illegal to have settlements built in the occupied land. Now, the last issue which I want to bring up is the issue of sovereignty. Under the Oslo Agreement, Palestinians were not to be accorded sovereignty. Under the Oslo Agreement, Palestinians were not to be accorded sovereignty. What Rabin was speaking about is dividing sovereignty over land versus sovereignty over people. That the Palestinian Authority will be given the responsibility over the population in what is called either limited autonomy and then to speak of expanded autonomy, while sovereignty over land will be maintained on the hands of the Israelis. Therefore, that which is underneath the ground belongs to Israel. That is which is above the ground belongs to Israel. That's why a Palestinian in the West Bank cannot dig a well in his own backyard to benefit from the water that might be underneath his own land. Most of the aquifers in the West Bank are reserved for the benefit of the settlements, and also the water is drawn to Israel. This is dividing the sovereignty over land from sovereignty over people. The Palestinian Authority will be given sovereignty over people, and the Israelis will maintain sovereignty over land. If you look in terms of access into borders, you will see at every juncture the Israelis maintain this control. If you pass through the Jordan River to cross into the West Bank, you will find that you are met with a Palestinian, possibly, with a Palestinian flag, but this is only what you call the, not the reality, but rather it is the facial part of the occupation. You give your passport to the Palestinian who might greet you in Arabic if you are an Arab. You might think that you are coming into an Arab territory that is a sovereign territory. The person takes your passport and hand it out to an Israeli who is in a window that you can't see him. And then the Israeli takes your passport and then reviews it to see whether you are somebody who said something against Israel or somebody who had protested or somebody that belongs to quote-unquote illegal organizations and so on. If you're approved, they give you the stamp and then the Palestinian gives you back your passport and tell you tafaddal, welcome. If not, he tells you no, you cannot come. This is the reality of the occupation, which the Israelis repositioned their troops and did not change the principles of the occupation. The land in the West Bank is still occupied, the Gaza Strip is still occupied, and what is there is only an authority that moved the population from the responsibility of Israel to the Palestinian Authority as a means of trying to remove the pleas and the appeals that used to go to the Israeli Supreme Court from many of the bleeding heart liberals. This is the statement of Rabin in saying how they found somebody to implement their own security for the first time in the history of Israel. So this is really the Oslo Agreement is finding somebody to implement Israeli security vis-a-vis the Palestinian, and not to secure the Palestinians from the Israelis who have been killing far more of them over the past 50 years of the occupation. And this is the lopsided nature of the Oslo Agreement that came as a result of the political power of the United States that was mobilized to support Israel at the end of the Gulf War. And this is how it should be understood vis-a-vis the Oslo Agreement. So hopefully if you have a question during the answer question period, I will be expanding more. Thank you.
Why the Al-Aqsa Intifada started. I mean, Palestinians are under very dire circumstances, and we're going to learn more this evening about that. Now I'd like to introduce the Asher Shmali. He is from Sacramento. He's a member of ABC Sacramento chapter, and he's going to speak about the links between the Palestine Liberation Movement and other movements for justice. Please welcome the Yas.
Good evening. About 10 days ago or so, I returned from Palestine. I returned, and for me, it was a personal sad situation, for my father had passed away. But there was, along with a funeral for one's own father, there was also a series of funerals every day. He would get up in the morning and he would wonder whose funeral it is that I will walk into today. And thousands every day will walk in a funeral. Maybe that of a neighbor, maybe that of a son, maybe that of a father, of a mother, of a sister, maybe of a baby. But there were always lineups of funerals. Some stand and pity the Palestinian people and grant us mercy, for we are indeed dying. And some stand and say, it is time to stop the suffering of this people. But what I want to talk about today for just a minute or so, a very brief and from the heart message, that our dying, much like many peoples everywhere, is not that of pity and doesn't deserve it. It's not that of mercy and does not deserve it. It is that of pride. It is death for life. It is not death so that we can have a Congress or a world body ask for end of violence. It is a death so that we can celebrate our life. We, as we send our sons and our daughters yet to their graves every day, we send with them a message of hope that we instill in each and every one of us, that one day this land called Palestine, one day will reign free, and that we Palestinians, many of us dead, many of us alive, but most of us are not yet born, will for certain rule our destiny and for certain be masters of our land. That is the message of our death. <laughs> 52 years ago, in a land far from here, a system of government was established called apartness. 52 years ago, 1948, apartheid was established as the polity, the state of government in the country of South Africa. 52 years ago, in a land very far from here, where people toiled in their olive groves, where people had nothing to do with World War II, where people had nothing to do with Europe, another polity was established, another exclusivist theocracy was established, also called apartness, with a different name, the Zionist State of Israel, 1948, along with apartheid. Both were established at the same time. For 52 years, Palestinians waged a war. And for many, many decades later and before, South Africans waged a war. But that war wasn't just about our land. I don't know how far I can go and how much I can say it and how much these folks can say it to you as you look them in the eye, or that little boy can tell you as you look him in the eye as he died. That struggle was not about land. In South Africa, it was not about land. And in Palestine, it was not about land. And in Nicaragua, it was not about land. And in Ireland, it was not about land. And in the Philippines, it wasn't about land. And in Puerto Rico, it wasn't about land. And in El Salvador, it was never about land. It is never about land in Cuba. Was never about land in India. Was never about land anywhere, anywhere in the world. It is about human dignity. It is about us as a people, the so-called members of the third world, the so-called other side of the dichotomy of the North and the South. It is very much about our pride as individuals, our pride as a collective history, our pride in our culture, our unity, our solidarity with each other throughout the globe. That is our point. It was never an accident that the FSLN members of the Frente Sandinista had their training in Palestinian camps. It was never an accident that members of the FMLN, Farabundo Martín, El Salvador, had training in their Palestinian camps. It was never an accident that Israel stood proud and dignified with the apartheid regime in South Africa, supporting Somoza, supporting Batista, supporting the death squads in El Salvador, supporting Marcos, supporting the ongoing slaughter today in Puerto Rico, supporting every slaughter of every native people, yet the Palestinians stood every single time, just like others have stood with us, along the side of those that toiled in Africa, those who toiled in the United States. It is not an accident whatsoever that members of the Hopi and Navajo people of Big Mountain would render their support in their prayers for the Palestinian people across the globe. And it is not an accident that our people, Palestinians, know very well what it means to be a Native American. It is not an accident that we know how many Zapatas there are in Chiapas, that we understand what it means to be a Zapatista. It is because it is indeed the same struggle in a different part of the globe for the same cause, the same program, the same construct, the same modality for the future. And that is of pride for all people. That is the struggle of the Palestinian people, and that is your struggle. In 1947, November 29, today, 53 years ago, Palestine was partitioned. 2 decades later, the United Nations found it necessary to render November 29 a day in solidarity with the Palestinian people. We are perhaps grateful for the United Nations for recognizing the totality of the obliteration that it has presented our people with. But the solidarity with our people came far before, came from the Organization of African Unity, came from the non-allied nations, came from all the liberation movements across the globe. From the day we lost our land to our occupiers, to our colonists, from that day, solidarity began. As we come today to celebrate the solidarity with the Palestinian people, November 29, perhaps the most essential issue that we should all reflect on, that is the role of us as a people in the solidarity movement. Do we materialize what Sandino, what Martí, what Lumumba, what Nkrumah, what Nehru and others have done over the years, and render unconditional, clear support for a liberation movement? For ours is not a pity movement. Ours is a liberation movement. And we demand liberation, nothing else and nothing short of that. Our role as a people, Palestinians, that is to organize, is to educate, and to muster more power so that the defiance of these folks, and there is unfortunately seem quite a few to come, so that we can stand clear against this
colonial legacy that has befallen on us, but the role of the solidarity movement, the role of the peace and justice movement is to unite with the liberation movements everywhere, to link the Filipino to the Palestinians, the Puerto Rican to the Palestinians, the Native American to the Palestinians, the Indian to the Palestinians, the African American to the Palestinians, the women movement to the Palestinians, because we are all after one thing, our collective and our individual dignity. Should you stand with us, we will promise you and do that we will spearhead that fight to break that colonial rule. But if you leave us alone, we will also continue, but you will be part of the murderous camp. It is the responsibility of people in this country, the United States, to take up the responsibility of stopping the murder of the Palestinian people and the murder of all people everywhere. Let me end on a couple of notes. I'd like to read you a couple of statements from some individuals who have passed through history, because we want you to understand and we want to share with you the horrendous mentality and psyche that we are against. Allow me for a second. If Zionist settlers were to move into a region where there are wild animals to which the Jews are not accustomed, big snakes, etc., I shall use the natives prior to giving them employment in transient countries for the extermination of these animals. This is a text from Theodor Herzl, the architect and founder of what we call today the State of Israel, in his essay, The Jewish State. Between ourselves, it must be clear that there is no room for both peoples together in this country. There is no other way than to transfer the Arabs, the Palestinians, from here to neighboring countries, to transfer all of them. Not one village, not one tribe should be left. Head of the Jewish Agency. It was not as though there was a Palestinian people in Palestine considering itself as a people. And we came and threw them out and took their country away from them. They did not exist. Golda Meir. There is not a single Jewish village in this country, Israel, that has not been built on the site of an Arab village. Moshe Dayan explaining to a child why he found a bone while he was playing in a park, because that was a graveyard that the child was playing in of Palestinians. Had I brought quotes, and I do, from Guatemala, I would have told you about the native people of that land. But you know very well the story. I would have told you about Peru, about El Salvador, about Nicaragua, about Cuba, about Grenada, about every spot in this world where a Vietnam occurred, where another South Africa occurred. But that is not the place for me. That is the place for you and me together. And on that note, I want to make sure that I never asked you to do what is right, but I demand of you, on behalf of my people, and every one of them in here would stand and make the same demand, much like a woman has demanded to control her body, to control her destiny, much like a native man and a native woman anywhere We demand of you, all of us, from coast to coast, from all the five continents, as Palestinians, as people of color, as people of the oppressed part of this world, we demand of you the proper and clear and unconditional support for the liberation movement of the Palestinian people and all liberation movements. Only then can we triumph. Thank you very much.